Good evening, everybody. I am Mark Katchus, the editor of the Tampa Bay Times, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to Spotlight Tampa Bay, our sustainability series, presented by Tampa Electric. Great to have you with us tonight. How many folks here have been to Spotlights before? I'm seeing some hands go up. This is great to see. So it was almost 2 years ago that we launched the Spotlight Tampa Bay series as an opportunity to convene thought leaders, experts, and stakeholders to confront some of the big issues facing our community, our region, and our state. And I can't think of too many issues more critical to talk about than the quality of our water, which is the subject of tonight's conversation. Before we get there, I want to express our sincere gratitude to Tampa Electric for sponsoring tonight's event and for sponsoring and supporting the sustainability series. We greatly, greatly appreciate it. Yeah, you can clap. You can clap. I'd like to introduce a brief video that will explore what Tampa Electric's Florida Conservation and Technology Center has been up to. So let's take a look at that real quick.
Tampa Electric's Florida Conservation and Technology Center, there's power in partnership. On 500 acres near our Big Bend power plant, we and our partners help to protect and preserve Florida's unique ecosystem. At our Manatee Viewing Center, the gentle giants gather in our protected refuge. Rehabilitated manatees are often released here, thanks to our accommodations and our partners' dedicated care. At our Clean Energy Center, we research renewable energy, and visitors interact with educational games. At the Florida Aquarium's Research Center, rescued sea turtles are rehabilitated, then released, and coral is spawned to help save reef tracks. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission holds camps so kids can kayak, fish, and more. It also spawns sport fish, partnering with the University of Florida on hatchery techniques. And we support the Guy Harvey Foundation to bring local teachers and students to this unique campus. It's all in the power of partnership.
And now I'd like to invite to the stage Carlos Aldazabal, who is the Vice President of Energy Supply at Tampa Electric. Carlos has been with TECO since 1999, serving in a variety of leadership and executive roles. He's also deeply engaged in the community, serving on the board of directors at the Florida Aquarium and at the Tampa Museum of Art. Let's give a warm welcome to Carlos.
Thank you, Mark. Humbled by that introduction. So I love doing things for the community. Tampa's been my home for the past 56 years. Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. Water is crucial for our region's resilience, and Tampa Electric is honored to support this event for our community to discuss the current challenges and explore the ways to contribute to our region's bright future. We're deeply committed to the initiatives that help protect and restore our region's vital water resources, and as you saw in the video, we support and partner with numerous organizations to make positive impacts. Our Manatee Viewing Center and our Florida Conservation and Technology Center are great examples of the work we do, the partnerships we foster, and the organizations we uplift to make meaningful improvements for our region's water quality and the coastal ecosystems we all enjoy and depend on. In addition, there are two upcoming projects that I'm excited to share with you. This spring, we're partnering with the Ecosphere Restoration Institute and the Florida Department of Environmental Protection to plant native seagrass near our Big Bend power station. If the pilot acre does well, we will plant up to 5 acres that can serve as long-term food for manatees, water quality filtration, coastal protection, and more. We're also working with the Ecosphere and the Tampa Bay Estuary Program to create 500 feet of living shoreline along Newman Branch Canal, also near our Big Bend Power Station. This will be a protected, stabilized coastal edge made of natural materials, and we plan to include a new tidal creek there behind mangroves. These are exciting projects for us, and they're great examples of the extra things industry partners like us can do to support the region's water resources and ecology. And finally, I want to tell you about a reclaimed water treatment partnerships. Years ago, our Polk Power Station needed to expand to keep up with the increasing energy demands of a growing region, and water was necessary to cool that plant. But it was critical to avoid depleting groundwater resources at the same time. Local governments needed a solution for managing their reclaimed water. So together with the City of Lakeland and the Southwest Florida Water Management District, we embarked on an award-winning project to use the City of Lakeland's treated wastewater to cool the power station. Later, the City of Mulberry also joined in. We now treat millions of gallons of water per day at the Polk Power Station on behalf of the cities and Polk County. We purify it, then use it to cool the power plant before purifying it yet again to the quality of drinking water. Ultimately, this partnership means less nitrogen in Tampa Bay, which means fewer harmful algae blooms, which helps improve populations of small fish, crabs, and oysters, supports healthy seagrass, and our friendly manatees' essential food supply. I'm sharing these initiatives because they're a testament to the power of partnership. We're all part of an interconnected community, region, and world. And the better we work together, the better our lives and the place we call home will be. Tampa Electric is a proud community partner who creates solutions for a brighter future, and that's why we're here tonight. I hope you enjoy the engaging conversation with an outstanding group of panelists. Now I'll turn it over back to Mark.
Let me say a couple more words about water. It's everywhere. Other than the sun that shines upon us, can you think of a feature in Florida that is more ubiquitous than water? And we haven't always taken good care of it. Red tide and blue-green algal blooms are intensifying. Municipalities are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to filter forever chemicals out of the water supply. Hurricanes Helene and Milton really laid bare the struggles and failures with some of our infrastructure, from stormwater collection systems to sewer systems. And phosphorus and nitrogen contamination has been wreaking havoc on our communities and our waterways throughout the state. How does that work? So when too much phosphorus and nitrogen gets into the waterways, it creates the conditions for algal blooms to proliferate and block the sun from doing its thing. And the sun is what allows photosynthesis to take place and for seagrass to thrive. When it's blocked, seagrass dies. When seagrass dies, manatees die. And just a few years ago, we saw what could happen when we experienced a severe manatee die-off in the state of Florida, where thousands of manatees perished. In the next couple weeks, the Tampa Bay Times is going to be publishing a major investigative story that delves into the root causes of the manatee die-off and the conditions that are present today allow this kind of pollution to continue. So you will want to keep your eyes out for that. It's coming very, very soon. Okay, Justine Griffin, I'm going to turn it over to you. Justine Griffin is the editor who oversees our economy and health coverage at the Tampa Bay Times. She's been with us for 10 years now. Happy anniversary, Justine. It's 10-year anniversary this year. Yeah. She does a phenomenal job overseeing some of the best coverage that we do at the Tampa Bay Times. She also does a great job moderating these conversations. So I am going to get out of the way, turn it over to Justine to introduce the panelists. Thank you very much for being here, everybody.
Hello. Thank you all for being here tonight. And just so you know, we have some members from the Times in the audience who, if you have questions, part of our discussion at the end, toward the end of the hour, we'll be taking questions from you. We're passing around cards that you can fill out, and then some folks from the Times will pick those up. So please raise your hand if you have a question at any point during our discussion. But thank you again for being here, and thank you to our panelists who I'm about to introduce. The topic of water quality feels so broad, right? Especially when we live in a place like Florida where we're surrounded by it, where water wants to intrude our homes during hurricane seasons. But as residents in Tampa Bay, we're all stewards of the water around us. And there, in our daily lives, there are things that we do that we probably don't think of that affect the quality of our water and overall health of our water. And I'm hopeful that we'll get into the intricacies of all of that tonight. But to start, I want to introduce you to all of our panelists. We're going to start at the end. Santino, if you can introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about the work you do, and we'll come back towards me.
Thank you. So good evening, everybody. And again, thank you to TECO for sponsoring this wonderful event. My name is Santino Provenzano. I'm the Senior Director of Environmental for the Mosaic Company. I think most everybody in the room probably knows who we are, but in case you don't, we are the largest domestic producer of crop nutrients in North America. My role with the company is I have all of the scientists, engineers, geologists that support our operations. I have a group that kind of is responsible for our permitting, works very closely with the permitting agencies. And then I also have all the folks that are embedded at our operating locations. Everyone from, like I said, engineers to biologists, and we also have a very large field services group that is doing all the environmental monitoring that's required by our operations. I think one of the reasons I'm here tonight is also not in my capacity with Mosaic, but I also am a representative and the chair of the Estuary Program's Nitrogen Management Consortium. I think that's a really unique partnership. Hopefully we can touch on that a little bit today, but in the opening comments, I think you heard a really important word, and that's partnership. And I think as we go through and talk to all the panelists tonight, you'll hear that if we really want to protect our water resources, you're going to need groups of people, kind of like this panel, that come from different areas, different walks of life, and different disciplines to really make a difference. So appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight, and look forward to the conversation.
Hi, my name is Margaret Mars Brisbane. I'm a professor at the USF College of Marine Science. My research focuses on phytoplankton ecology. I'm interested in all sorts of phytoplankton, but also harmful algal species like those that live around Tampa Bay. And I'm really interested in thinking about alternative sources of nutrients for harmful algal bloom species and thinking about some nutrients that are not our normal suspects. So we talk a lot about nitrogen, we talk a lot about phosphorus, fueling algal blooms, but I like to think about some trace nutrients that can also have a really big impact on algal growth. And I think a lot about bacteria and how bacteria can fuel algal growth. Most recently, I've been studying water quality after the major hurricanes that hit us in the fall. So about 10 days after Hurricane Milton, we were out in the Gulf collecting water samples and looking at how the hurricanes impacted water quality. And we've been following that up every month since then to see how the coastal ecosystem has rebounded after the hurricanes. So I'd be happy to answer questions about those things and looking forward to a really nice conversation.
Good evening, I'm Ed Truitt. I'm the executive director of the Tampa Bay Estuary Program. As Tina mentioned, thank you to TECO and the Times for putting this event on. It's a wonderful time to get the community together talking about some of the pressing issues that we work on as an organization. Tampa Bay Estuary Program is often confused with Tampa Bay Watch, but we are actually a government organization. We were actually designated by Congress as a national estuary program back in 1991, and there's 28 other national estuary programs throughout the country. And core to the goals of each estuary program is developing an overall blueprint to protect and restore the special places that Congress has designated as estuaries of national significance. So a lot of the work I do is directing the eight small but hardy staff that I have as the estuary program. to focus on research, restoration, and community outreach that is focused on protecting and restoring Tampa Bay. A lot of times we're a catalyst, as you've heard, working with other organizations, providing some seed source of funding to spur initiatives on to get the ball moving towards cleaner water, improving habitats, improving fish and wildlife, and getting the community engaged in those activities in the future. So a lot of our role is as a partnership organization, working across all these different agencies represented up here on the stage and probably in the audience out there as well.
Good evening. My name is Peter Clark. I'm the president and founder of Tampa Bay Watch. We're an environmental nonprofit. We've been working for 32 years now, providing community-based restoration programs for citizens and student groups and other groups that would like to get involved with hands-on projects to really help to restore water quality and habitat conditions in the Bay. And we learned early on that if we wanted to get volunteers during the week, we needed to start working with school kids too. So while we started with hands-on habitat restoration, we've really grown into marine science education as well. As our programs continue to develop and we continue to work with a lot of the other organizations and agencies around the Bay, the hands-on community-based restoration projects have really grown in size. Right now we do about 200 tons of oyster shell each and every year back into Tampa Bay in order to grow oyster communities that help to filter out the water, improve water quality, and reduce some of the algae blooms that we've heard about. We've also constructed a facility on the St. Petersburg Pier that helps to tell the story of the restoration and protection of the Tampa Bay estuary. So between our two facilities and a new program called Marine Science on the Move, we're able to touch about 17,500 kids each and every year, mostly Title I schools in our Tampa Bay community. So if you like how this sounds and you want to get involved with restoring and protecting the Bay, please go to our website, tampabaywatch.org, and sign up for our newsletter, and you'll find out about a lot of the other community-based programs all working together to make Tampa Bay a better place. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Warren Hogg. I am the Chief Science Officer for Tampa Bay Water. We are the region's wholesale water supplier, and we deliver about 200 million gallons of water per day to citizens and businesses in the Tampa area through the six local governments that are our members. We, through the division that I manage, the science division, we have a state-certified drinking water laboratory to make sure that the water we deliver every day is clean and safe to drink. We obtain all the permits for with taking water from the environment, but we monitor so that we make sure that the environment is not harmed by that water that we have to harvest for public use every day. We do climate change science and research to make to understand what climate change and sea level rise may have on the water resources of the Tampa area. We also promote water conservation because every water drop that you don't use at home is a drop that's left in the environment for that future use or for the environment to use. So we cover a lot of things all related to water because it's so precious for our region.
Thank you. So this first question I'd love for all of you to answer because I think coming from all different backgrounds, we'll get a bunch of different answers. So I'll give you a moment to think about this, but Warren, hopefully you can answer first. What do you feel is the largest threat facing our region's water quality today?
Everything revolves and focuses around Tampa Bay. It's the heart of the Tampa Bay area. We've seen great improvements over the last several decades. Probably everyone understanding what our individual part can be in improving the water of the Bay is critical to make sure that we're using fertilizer responsibly so that extra fertilizer nutrients don't run off into the Bay, making sure that stormwater systems are not used as disposal for yard waste or pet waste. Every single thing that as individuals we can do can help the Bay to recover and thrive.
So Tampa Bay has a great story to tell. we've been able to clean up a lot of the wastewater treatment plants that flow in the bay. We don't allow large-scale dredging and filling projects in the bay unless they mitigate for the damage that's caused somewhere else. We've been able to address a lot of the stormwater runoff that goes into the bay, and because of that, we've seen monumental improvements in the Tampa Bay estuary. But within the last 6 or 8 years, those gains that we've been able to make, we've started to lose. So there's really not one set answer other than the fact that what we've done in the past to make Tampa Bay where it is today probably isn't going to work in the future. We need to look at the individual parts of the bay, see what the problems are, and work to address those specific areas because of the unique needs that they have. But I'll also say, Mark hit it right on the head, nutrients drives water quality in the bay. If we're able to dial back nitrogen in particular and phosphorus that goes into the bay, we're able to reduce the algae blooms and get more seagrasses back in the bay, and that's the positive cycle that we really need to get back into.
Yeah, I was thinking about this more from a meta perspective, and I know everybody on the panel is going to kind of touch on some of the core messaging that we're working on as the estuary program. But getting back to, I think, some of the comments that are already stated, you know, the biggest threat to Tampa Bay is you and I, the collective we in this room, and the inactions that and choices we make as individuals that roll up as a community of now 3.5 million people living in and around the watershed. So when you think about it, we all drive cars. We all are eating the food that is probably coming from fertilized crops. We're all using electricity. We all have homes that displace native habitats that used to filter the rainfall and the stormwater that was falling on our watershed that ultimately ends up in Tampa Bay. So we have personal choices that we can make, and there's collective choices we can make as a community to ensure that we protect the water quality, because we're basically have a water quality debt or burden from all those actions, those collective actions, the 3.5 million people that live in this watershed. And if we're not making investments to keep up with the pace of some of that development and some of those impacts, then you're going to see what's going on in the bay now. We're going to fall behind in terms of maintaining a healthy Tampa Bay. And really, it takes all of us and the will and the collective will to say, yes, we want to invest in clean water in Tampa Bay. We know what we need to invest in. We just need the will and the resources to do it.
Well, my answer got stolen a little bit, because what I was thinking is mostly development and the extreme rate of conversion of coastal habitat to condos, roads, sidewalks, and the impact that that type of conversion has on runoff into the water. The more concrete we have, the more water is going to run off into Tampa Bay, and the more development we have, the more that water is going to contain pollution, chemicals, and nutrients. And while it's really important for all of us to act as individuals and make the best choices that we can, in order to make really big changes, we need policymakers and regulators to also be on board. So beyond making good choices with your food and your clothes and all of those things, we also really need to be talking to our legislators and making sure that they're making good choices for our region.
Yeah, I mean, coming on the back end of this, I think everybody's really touched on everything, but if you go back to my opening comments, this idea of partnership, and that's really what's required, because I understand where the question comes from, but it's not a single thing. So whether it's, you know, more responsible use of crop nutrients on a commercial or farm scale, or even the fertilizer you use in your home, think of all the development, as Ed said. I don't know the exact number, Ed, maybe you do, but I think every new person in the area produces about 100 gallons a day of wastewater. So that wastewater comes with nutrients that have to be treated, and that water has to go somewhere. So I don't really think there's any one thing to point at. I think what it underscores is that, you know, there's going to have to be multiple solutions to get the end result. And it's going to take pretty much everyone in the community and some political will to start investing in our infrastructure and improvements that maybe we haven't over the last 20, 30 years if we really want to continue to move water quality forward.
Ed, can you talk more about that political will? What are state and local governments doing to help?
Yeah, I think, like Peter alluded to, the story of Tampa Bay is one of cooperation and collaboration and proactiveness. So we don't need to wait on Tallahassee or DC to deliver a clean water environment for the Tampa Bay estuary. We've invested in it in the past, and we've had great success. We reached peak seagrass conditions back in 2016. Since that time, we've seen some declines. And we need to refocus efforts, make sure we're making the right investments moving forward. And I think sort of the gap that I see now is, you know, because we start assembling information and report to both the state Department of Environmental Protection and the US EPA on sort of progress in trying to meet these water quality or other ecosystem goals. So we know what projects are on the books. And just as an example, you know, over the next 5 years, the region's gonna invest probably about $260 million towards nitrogen load reduction projects. That's a big number. That's a great number. We wanna see that to continue. But in one of our most problematic areas, like Old Tampa Bay, we could do the back of the napkin calculations of what's actually needed. We know we need to reduce nitrogen loads into Old Tampa Bay by about 25%. It takes about $3,500 per pound to remove nitrogen from stormwater. We need about 90 tons of reduction to restore the health of Old Tampa Bay. That's $630 million just in the Old Tampa Bay segment. So the good investments we are making, the $260 million we are making bay-wide, pales into comparison of the need where we're seeing these issues. And that's sort of the political will that's now needed. If clean water is a priority, then we need to have the political will to invest real dollars into maintaining the health of Tampa Bay. And that's where we're seeing gaps now.
Peter, I feel like we've identified early on that we are the problem. We are the major polluter as residents who live here. Can you talk more about just getting that message out there to the community? Do you feel like the majority of us understand the weight we're adding to this problem day to day?
I think for the most part, the community appreciates what we have here in our backyard, the beautiful Tampa Bay estuary, the Gulf of Mexico. A lot of times when we have incidents like a red tide bloom or the Piney Point spill, that brings attention, that brings awareness, and people really feel like they need to do something about it. In a way, that public attention to the problems that we have is what helps to drive concern and the political funding or political climate to start to get things done. But on a day-to-day basis, it's a marathon. As Ed said, it costs a lot of money in order to restore and protect the bay. And I think for the most part, we have a lot of great support here, but we're fighting against this huge population growth coming into our area. So even though we have good rules and regulations, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. And clearly, if you've driven over on Eastern Hillsborough Bay, you can see these huge developments going in a replacing agricultural fields over there. So, you know, we like to pat on ourselves on the back because of the huge improvements that we've made in Tampa Bay, but we have a lot of work if we're going to be able to maintain what we've started to be able to do here in our backyard.
Sure. All right, this next one's for you, Santino. Over the years, Mosaic has had a number of pollution incidents, including in 2016 when phosphate wastewater polluted our aquifer. What can you tell the people who are here tonight about Mosaic's, who are concerned about Mosaic's pollution record? And can you give us any peace of mind about the large projects that the company is currently undergoing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously 2016 is a while ago, but I was actually on the front lines of that. And, you know, natural hazard develops under one of the phosphogypsum stacks, which is a byproduct of our process. We are obligated under federal law to stack that material. At the moment, there's not any approved commercial use for that material. I think the biggest controversy around that was disclosure and transparency, and I think our company learned a really important lesson there. That led to some regulatory changes around reporting of pollution incidents in all across the state, and now you know, everybody is subject to those requirements. But in terms of, like, you know, what comes next, I mean, I think we worked very closely for a couple of years with DEP to put together a new program for those stacks. We're doing things like subsurface monitoring with acoustics. We're doing three-dimensional mapping of features that might be present in the natural strata before we even develop a new area. So there's been significant kind of technical improvements in terms of what has to go into the design before you can even go to DEP and get a permit for a new development. And those are being implemented across the industry now. I guess just, you know, kind of final thought on that, you know, when we talked about this thing about collaboration, and I don't want anybody in the audience tonight to get the sense that we're pointing back at individuals as kind of like the only reason that we have kind of the struggle in front of us to maintain the gains that we've seen in Tampa Bay. I think you see that tonight in TECO's sponsorship of this event. You know, you heard about some of the projects they're funding. You know, I think we're always open to those opportunities and partnerships. So I think that's a big part. If you want to do business in this community and we want to gain your trust and we want to be a trusted partner, I think companies need to step up and do the right thing as well. So, I mean, I guess just to put a bow on that, you know, things like that, when they happen, you take a step back, you know, you work with the regulatory authorities to improve, and you put processes in place so that those things don't happen again.
Santino, can you talk to us a little bit more about some of the more recent initiatives by Mosaic? I understand the company is currently asking our government for the ability to inject wastewater deep into the earth in four different spots across Tampa Bay. Are there concerns that this practice could cause a similar leak to the aquifer?
Yeah, so fair question. First of all, injection wells are not new in the state of Florida. The type of well that probably everybody is aware of that we're pursuing right now with the department is a test well. So this is really an initial step for us to do some drilling, understand the geology better, and really prove out whether the concept works at that particular site. So, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily connect it in terms of, like, the incident that happened in Central Florida. What I would say is the reason we're looking at that as an option for disposal is because we are sensitive to the fact that we want to try and find other ways to keep nutrients out of surface water systems. So, you know, if we have rainfall, or if we have a facility to close, you know, that could be an option for the industry to do that in a responsible way. So again, I just think, you know, UIC is not, it's not a new technology. It's actually used in a widespread manner. And, you know, again, the first step for us is to go through that exploratory well permitting, drill that well, test that well, and then there will be a second process to determine if we can get the operations permit from DEP. One final thought on UIC. I think everybody in the room is probably aware a well like that was installed at Piney Point. Recall the incident that happened a couple of years ago at that facility. That was a facility that was associated with a company that went bankrupt and literally walked away. And that all predated some of the kind of financial assurance requirements that the industry is required to have today, and really left the state and the county, Manatee County, kind of holding the bag. And, you know, I'll point out that there were probably some decisions made on how that property was used that maybe in hindsight, you know, could have been better. But at the end of the day, they went through the process of getting the UIC well. And I think there was an article in the Times recently indicating that that facility is nearing closure. So that is going to be a good news story and one less thing that the area will have to deal with in terms of a potential risk for water quality for Tampa Bay.
Ed, did you have something to add?
Yeah, I just want to add to what Tino was explaining. I think what people don't realize, there's about 189 major permitted sources that have permits to discharge either to surface waters or groundwaters in Tampa Bay. So they're not the only entity that has a nitrogen load burden that is exploring these wells as disposal. And it's a trade-off, quite frankly. Those 189 permits represent municipal wastewater treatment plants. Those are the facilities that are treating everything that's going down the toilet when we flush our waters, to industrial facilities by the port. So each one of those facilities has a, now what's called an allocation or a piece of the pie that they're allowed to discharge to Tampa Bay. Those were decisions that we made early on to help protect and restore Tampa Bay to get it back to that pristine condition that I talked about back in 2016. And a lot of that work has happened through the investments of those individual companies as well as governments to get us to a place back in 2016 where we had the most seagrasses we ever had on record. The questions now in terms of what to do with that water, it's not this or that. It's sort of the trade-offs that are going to occur with those ongoing activities that we have to think about and deal with as a community. And the best we can do, I think, as a collective, is think about water holistically. These wastewater streams are a commodity that can be used for wetland hydration. They could be used for reuse, for irrigation, so that we don't have to rely on pumping water out of the ground from our drinking water supplies just to put it back on the earth to keep our grasses green. So there's ways we could deal with this water more holistically and think about it more holistically in terms of benefits that matriculate to Tampa Bay. So those are the things that I think we need to have as community conversations. That's why, you know, Santino sits on our Nitrogen Management Consortium as a co-chair representing the industry, is that can't work in silos with one another. We have to deal with it. We're living in the space together, and we have to work together in order to deal with the waste that we produce from all the different activities. Individually, we're creating different sorts of waste streams that we have to deal with. Industries are dealing with different sorts of waste streams that they have to deal with. But we need to start thinking holistically how better to use that water so that we're not just siloed into sort of these operations that don't benefit the all. So I just wanted to add that.
Maggie, this next one's for you. As we continue to see how climate change is affecting our daily lives in Florida, how are the warming temperatures in the air and the water impacting our Gulf?
Well, that's a really big question. I can answer that question from the biology side. So for a lot of microbes, bacteria, and harmful algal bloom species, when it's warmer, their growth rate is higher. So up until a certain point, if it gets too hot, then they all die. But we're not quite there yet. So as the waters are getting warmer, they're able to grow more quickly. And if there's more nutrients available, then that can support that higher growth rate. And then we'll see higher biomass of harmful algal bloom species that we would rather probably not want to see in our waters.
So just this last week, you were out in the Gulf, right? Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about the work you were doing?
Yeah, sure. So we organized with FWC and a bunch of different labs at USF a response cruise to the very large Carinia brevis bloom that was happening off southwest Florida. And our primary goal was to sample across the bloom and the edges, the middle, and the outside to get a better sense of the different life stages of Carinia and how they were responding to environmental conditions. It was very rough, there was a lot of wind, and we kind of caught the tail end of that bloom rather than being right in the middle of the patch. But it's a really interesting thing to think about because a lot of our conversation around harmful algal blooms is really focused on what's causing them, but there's the other side of the coin where we should also be thinking about what's killing them, what's causing blooms to end. So it was a really interesting time to be out in a bloom to get a lot of samples that will take time to analyze, but we'll be thinking about some of the factors that contribute to the demise of a large bloom like that.
I do. When you're out there on the bay, and I know there's a lot of fishermen spend a lot of time out there. When I first started working on Tampa Bay back in the 1980s, the northern part of the bay was mostly salt marsh grass. The southern part of the bay was where all the mangroves are. And as climate changes and the temperatures rise, mangroves pretty much are taking over the entire Tampa Bay system. And you can see it all the way up into the Panhandle and even Louisiana as well. But there are a lot of things that we can do here in Tampa Bay that help to keep up with rising sea levels and global warming. It's called green infrastructure. Projects like oyster bars, if you're able to get them back into the bay, not only improve water quality, but since they grow on top of each other, they can continue to rise up as sea level rises out in the bay as well. So a lot of local communities around the bay are looking at these different types of green infrastructure that they can install that'll help protect their shoreline while continuing to provide natural resources back to the Tampa Bay system.
So Warren, this next question is for you. We've seen some quick and large cuts to the federal workforce in recent months, which includes some important scientific organizations that have homes here in Florida, from NOAA to the EPA. Are you concerned that these cuts will have an impact here locally, or on our ability to maintain and monitor water quality?
We don't yet know what the cuts will cause. We're always concerned with agencies like NOAA, who provides invaluable data for hurricane response, letting us know ahead of time what's coming, when it could grow, where things may go. So certainly that's a concern that we're watching. We do use a lot of data from them in our climate assessments and also to prepare for the storms that will come. For the EPA, they set a lot of regulations that protect us, the water quality that we all share, and also the programs, the environmental programs, such as the establishment of the estuary programs. The EPA does play a critical role and has for many years in helping us protect our natural resources. So hopefully they can manage their way through the cuts that have happened and still provide the same level of protection and information services.
Okay. So Ed, I think this one's for you. It doesn't take a massive weather event to overwhelm our stormwater infrastructure anymore. Millions of gallons of sewage is purged into our bay after storms. It happens so frequently these days that it feels almost commonplace. But what kinds of long-term effects will this have on our waterways?
Responding to this question kind of touches on your other question related to climate change. There's a whole lot more heat in the water in our atmosphere that's creating sort of these deluge events that we haven't typically experienced relatively over the past century. But we just thinking back to 2016, starting in Hermine, Ian, Adalia, Debbie, Milton, these are close to 100-year storm events that put at least a foot and a half of water to 2 feet of water in certain places and cause real problems. None of our infrastructure is prepared for those sorts of deluges. As we continue to be more of a tropical environment in the Tampa Bay region rather than a subtropical environment, those extremes are probably going to be more present, and we can't design our infrastructure to handle a 2-foot storm. And as I mentioned, we're woefully behind in terms of keeping pace with the amount of growth and handling the water that's occurring in a normal rainy season. So you add those sort of compounding events onto our infrastructure now, that's where the call and need for investment needs to take place. Back in the 1970s, there was some significant state legislation put into place that led to basically the Howard F. Kern plant, which is the city of Tampa's wastewater treatment plant, going to advanced treatment. At the time, it was about $90 million. 75% of that was paid through the federal government, through taxes. We stand to lose sort of that leveraging of funding now moving forward at a time where we're ill-prepared to deal with what's coming along the west central coast, Florida coast. If we experience 2-foot rainfall events over 24-hour periods, we're going to be in trouble in terms of where we currently are developed and where we're continuing to develop into the future. So that sort of intentional thought of thinking about what is the future of this place. We have 3.5 million people right now. We're expecting another 1 to 1.5 million people in this finite space we call Tampa Bay. Those spaces that absorb that rainfall are going away and becoming less. in terms of stormwater ponds that could handle deluges like that. So we need to get real about the situation and start thinking about 10, 15 years down the road and plan for that, because it's these type of events that we experience over the past 7 years are probably going to be the new normal and not the anomalies.
With the storm surge that we've seen in the last few years with the hurricanes that we've had and our understanding of how sea level is rising, it's important for local governments to understand what the maximum storm surge could be with sea level rise. So as a stormwater or a wastewater treatment facility is reaching the end of its life and they need to replace it, they'll understand better not to replace it on that same site, but to move further inland to a higher elevation so that it's protected from future storm surge. So we can use that information to plan better for the future. Another great initiative that we're taking throughout the area is underground power. Since, and almost all of us were touched during Hurricane Milton with power outages, but in places where it makes sense to bury those lines, it reduces the risk of power outage because of trees falling on lines. So there are things that we can do. They're just very expensive options, and they're a longer-term solution. But incrementally, we can make changes that improve our quality of life.
So we've reported in the Tampa Bay Times, and we've already mentioned it here a few times, that we've seen some significant loss in seagrass in recent years. Peter, can you tell us why seagrass is important to our waterways and what is being done to help reverse that trend?
Yeah, if you spend a lot of time on the bay, if you're a fisherman, you go to the seagrass beds or the oyster bars in order to catch fish. Seagrasses grow along the bottom of the bay. They are a grass like the grass in your lawn. As they cover the bottom of the bay, they need light to grow. And when you have poor water quality, you have a lot of nutrients causing these algae blooms that shades out the seagrass beds. Over the last 150 years, we probably lost about 81% of our seagrass beds as a whole to urbanization activities. Now, we've been able to bring a lot of that back, and using about 1950 as the standard, we're able to reach our targets that had been set in Tampa Bay. But as we pointed out a couple of times, we've lost about 30% of that gain from the Tampa Bay estuary because of a lot of the different problems that are occurring recently, as well as climate change being added to the mix. But these communities grow on the bottom of the bay, extremely productive in terms of fisheries and shellfish and other habitat resources, but they also help to improve water quality by stabilizing the bottom, filtering out the water as well. So the health of Tampa Bay is really driven by seagrass. When you get the good seagrass numbers, you know you're heading in the right direction in Tampa Bay.
Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, I think Peter did a great job talking about the importance of seagrass, and I think what we're concerned about at the Tampa Bay Estuary Program in particular is where there hasn't been recovery as of late from that dip from since 2016. And one of the bay segments in particular, Old Tampa Bay, is where we are probably going to be at an all-time record low, all-time, even going back to like 1950s, 1980 estimates in Old Tampa Bay. It's that area of the bay that where the three bridges span from Pinellas and Hillsborough County. There's places in Old Tampa Bay where there's been lush seagrass beds for a number of years, and it's barren flat. And that's scary to me because that is a significant area of Tampa Bay that has struggled in the past, but we've never lost the amount of seagrasses that we have over the past 8 years. And it's almost analogous to the tipping point that is seen on the other coast in Indian River Lagoon about 2010, when there's significant seagrass declines. And then there's all these cascading ecological events, harmful algal blooms. There's impacts to manatees because they had no food resources. We're getting to that point in Old Tampa Bay. We're almost beyond a tipping point, and we need to recognize that something needs to be done. And it's not one smoking gun to fix that bay segment. Nutrients play a big part. Continued to reduce nutrients flowing into that bay segment, but there's really poor tidal circulation because of the causeways in that bay segment as well that have led to seasonal summertime harmful algal blooms that produce a similarly rust-colored red tide-like condition, but it's actually caused by Pyridinium bahamense, which produces a toxin. People don't know about that, but that happens every summer in Old Tampa Bay. That affects sort of the persistence of seagrass through shading out the light that can reach the bay bottom. That's been going on since the 2010s, and we need to get a hold of that situation, and it's not, like I said, one smoking gun. It's multiple things and levers that need to be pulled as a management community, focused on reducing nutrients, improving tidal circulation, looking at ways that we could implement green infrastructure to handle these new deluges of stormwater that are entering in that system and are the primary loading and sources of nutrients flowing into that bay segment. So those are the things that we need to do, we need to get real about in Old Tampa Bay, or else, you know, we stand to lose a whole lot more seagrass over the next 5-10 years.
There's a lot of problems going on in Upper Tampa Bay, and interesting fact, Lake Tarpon drains down to the northern part of Upper Tampa Bay. It never used to drain to Upper Tampa Bay. It drained north to the Anclo River. Well, we had some hurricanes back in the early 1960s, so the Army Corps of Engineers constructed this large drainage canal to drain Lake Tarpon south into northern Tampa Bay. And because of that, we have all these extra nutrients that really don't belong in that part of the bay, and they've literally been building up for years and years and years. So in many cases, we're still dealing with problems that were created, in this case, back in the 1960s. So there's some tough problems going on in Upper Tampa Bay. Be working on that for a long time.
And, you know, just to follow up on that, you know, that's getting back to the point where we're thinking about water resources holistically. That's also being considered as an alternative water supply for the region, our need for fresh, clean water. That water could be used for drinking water supply rather than discharged into Upper Old Tampa Bay with its latent nutrient burden that goes into that bay segment. So we need to start thinking about, across agencies, what are the best uses of that water? How do we meet the needs of our community while also improving the ecosystem? And there's ways to do that. We just need to, like I said, invest in them.
Thank you for the lead-in on that one. As Tampa Bay Water looks for how are we going to meet the growing water demand, the growing water need of the Tampa area, we do look into the future at projects. And one of those projects is taking part of the flow that comes out of Lake Tarpon into the upper part of Tampa Bay. And by doing that and treating it for drinking water, we can remove some of those nutrients and remove some of that excess freshwater flow from coming into the bay. So that might be a win, a multiple win, that we have a water supply source. We actually may help improve that part of the bay over time. It's something that we're studying for the next 2 years, and we'll see if it turns out to be a feasible project. But it would have one, it would be one that has multiple benefits.
So just a reminder to our audience, if you have a question, please write them down on these cards. We've got a nice stack so far. And so our first audience question is a good one for you, Warren. Is there a potential for the Tampa Bay area to run out of clean drinking water within the next 10 years? If so, what is the plan to combat that?
Tampa Bay Water exists to make sure that there's clean, safe water supply for the region today and into the future. So we will not run out of water. What we might run out of is cheap water. There's plentiful water. There's the Gulf is full of seawater that could be desalinated. It's just the most expensive way to develop water. So the master water plan looks into the future for 20 plus years to see what's the growing population, how much water will we need, and develop specific projects. We do have enough water to meet the region's growing needs through the year 2028, and we're increasing the size of our surface water treatment plant that treats river water. That'll take us through the year 2033. We're also looking at those next projects, like the water that comes out of Lake Tarpon, to have in place from 2023 into the future. So we're always looking on a five-year cycle to get ahead of that growth demand to make sure that we will not run out of clean, safe water.
What about reclaimed water? Would we ever get to a point where we would consider that, processing that for drinking water?
Reclaimed water is a very large possible source, but it's not at the point where we can turn a project into drinking water. We need to do more research. We need to do a lot of public engagement to make sure that the community is receptive of those projects. Technically, we can clean water to any standard and make it completely pure. But we have to work with the public and make sure we do it right. As we treat water, we put multiple barriers in place, and every time water goes through a treatment barrier, it gets cleaner and cleaner and cleaner. And when it leaves our treatment plant, it meets or exceeds the quality that's required by all state and federal drinking water requirements. We do have a project, however, that's using reclaimed water for drinking water without actually using it. Hillsborough County is injecting highly treated reclaimed water into very deep wells right along Tampa Bay in South Hillsborough County. That helps to prevent saltwater intrusion from moving into the aquifer, but it also creates a water level increase in the freshwater aquifer inland. So we're working with the county and the Water Management District to see if we could site a freshwater well field about 5 miles inland to harvest a little bit of that increase in water level and turn that into a clean drinking water source that uses reclaimed water, but the water would never get back to the well field. So we're investigating ways of, again, getting multiple wins through partnerships to help the environment and provide drinking water sources.
Ed, did you have something to add?
Yeah, just adding to what Warren was saying, I want to give a shout out to City of Plant City, Lynn Spivey. They have a One Water initiative that they've implemented as a pilot project. They're reusing wastewater right now for drinking water supply. They recognize that they were going to be in a deficit for supply need for their community within the next couple of decades. So they advanced this sort of technology to look at new sources because they're in a water use caution area, because they can't overly pump groundwater sources in that region. So they're actually using reuse water right now through that pilot project. I think Kiel Winery and Brewery is actually making beer out of that water now. So there's examples in the community where this reuse water is being used for drinking water supply. We have the technology to do it. We put astronauts into space that are drinking basically the waste that is produced in the space stations on space shuttles. So we have the technology. It's more of the cringe factor getting past that and thinking holistically about water resources again and how best to use them in the future.
So what's the name of the beer?
I do know it, but it's not coming to mind right now.
Tampa Bay Water is working with local governments to look at that potential for using reclaimed water, as Ed mentioned, Plant City is looking at. Those are longer-term studies for us. We need to make sure the regulations are in place. We do a lot of public outreach to get the community's feedback. And they're not ready for projects for us yet on a large scale, but we're studying them that when all those things line up, those projects can come into our master water plan for consideration at that time.
Santino, maybe you can tackle this audience question. Do you have any ideas of how to inspire legislators into acting instead of just offering money just to talk about water quality?
Wow, if I really knew the answer to that, I probably wouldn't. I would be in a different line of work. But look, I think it's, look, everybody knows the current political environment and what everything right now seems to be about spending and taxes and spending money wisely. And I mean, I'm sure, like in anything, there are efficiencies out there. But I mean, I think we have to resist the temptation of like throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? There is a lot of good public spending. And whether you're on one side of the political spectrum or the other, I think what we can do collectively is get in touch with our representatives And we need to create a safe space for them to say, look, I'm not giving you an endorsement to tax me into oblivion, but there are things that we need in this community to achieve some of the goals that we're talking about, whether it's new water sources or protecting our bay. I feel like a lot of times we don't give enough space to our elected officials to do that. We have to get in touch with them and tell them, hey, maybe this isn't 100% aligned with some of your peers, but it's important to our community. So whether you have an R next to your name or a D next to your name or something else, this is what we need you to focus on. So that would be my advice. And look, I can tell you our local officials, some of them like me, some of them don't, because I'm calling them all the time. If there's potholes in the road, I'm calling them, you know, I'm one of those people. So I think we need to make sure that they understand what's important to us as a community, and again, make it safe for them to maybe step outside, you know, what their party line is to do the things that are right.
Anyone else want to chime in on that? No? Okay, Maggie, this next question is for you. Can you expand on the test on the water testing after Helene and Milton that you participated in, and what did you find initially and monthly since then?
Sure. So the water testing that we've been doing has been a transect from the mouth of Tampa Bay out over the shelf. And we've been measuring a number of things, including nutrient concentrations, bacterial cell counts. Those things we can get back rather quickly, and we can see that there's a really strong gradient where bacterial cell counts and nutrient concentrations were really high in the mouth of the Gulf, and there was a gradient where they got lower further offshore. A lot of the other work that we're doing is a little bit more intensive, where it takes more time to get the results back. So we're doing genetic sequencing so we can get a better handle on not just how many bacteria are there, but who exactly is there and what are they doing. And I'm very excited for those results, but I don't have them for you yet.
If I could ask a question, you know, I think most people have finally realized that red tide is a natural phenomenon, but we're seeing a lot more of it. It seems to be very, very persistent down south. They can almost expect a bloom each and every year. And, you know, it's always nice to find out what the state of the science is. Where do you think we're headed with this red tide that seems to be getting stronger, lasting longer? It's going farther up the bay. It's a real problem, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a very complex problem. I think the state of the science right now is that it's very much driven by physical processes in the ocean, and the physical processes in the ocean are affected by larger climate patterns. So the changing currents and the changing temperatures are having a large impact on where and how long the blooms are.
So Sarasota is going to be dealing with this for a while then?
There is no quick fix. I think there has been some news recently about mitigation efforts, things that we might be able to add to make it go away. And I think that we need to be really careful about that type of thing. Anytime that we're putting a Band-Aid on a big problem, we're potentially causing larger problems down the road.
Okay. So I think we'll talk more about this before this conversation is over, but what are some ways the community can work to limit non-point source nitrogen and phosphorus pollution? Who wants to take that?
That's a good start. There are individual actions you can think about, what you do in your yard, like fertilizing during the summer months when there are fertilizer ordinances in place that talk about the proper use of fertilizer when we're in our rainy season. You think about different actions there. You get to think about your yard as being a stormwater basin that can filter rainfall that's coming off your roof, off your impervious surfaces, so you could plant native habitats within your yards to further polish that rainwater in the future. You could think about our collective use of fossil fuels. A lot of things are talked about in terms of carbon dioxide pollution, but there's also nitrogen oxide pollution as part of emissions from burning fossil fuels that end up as a nutrient source that goes into Tampa Bay. So you can make different choices about how you interface with fossil fuels in the future. You could pick up after your pet. If you leave pet waste behind, you know, that's a source of pollution, namely bacterial pollution that's going into Tampa Bay, but it also could be a source of nutrients. So those individual actions, you know, will add up if 3.5 million people are all doing that. If not, then we're going to continue to have sort of these large slugs of nutrients that come with rainfall events that are washing that pollution into the bay in one way or another. So those are some small things that I could think of off the top of my head, but there's 20 more.
So we've mentioned this a couple times, that we've sort of seen this regression since 2016 in terms of like the health of our water quality. Can we talk about why that's happened? What's led to that slip from 2016? Whoever, Peter, do you want to start?
I wish I knew. I think we've talked about not really having a smoking gun. Ed talked about Upper Tampa Bay. The water quality up there is very transitional. So when we have periods of good water quality, literally thousands of acres of bay bottom get recolonized with seagrass beds. And then when water quality degrades, that's a big area where we lose large quantities of seagrass. And we've talked about the problems in Upper Tampa Bay. We've got causeways, we've got hotter temperatures in the water. So Upper Tampa Bay is really kind of our poster child as we look in the future. If we want to make measurable progress back toward our goals, that's going to be a big focus of attention. But we're also seeing other minor areas around the bay for different reasons are suffering from water quality and loss of seagrass. And they just need to be treated differently. They need to be addressed uniquely because of the individual problems that they have in that area. Whether it's wastewater overflows from hurricanes, you know, we had 20 inches of rainfall from Milton. That's a huge amount of water in a very short amount of time, carrying a lot of pollutants down into the bay. And the bay is just having a difficult time being able to heal itself.
I'm going to be calling our organization out, but I think a lot of times we can, what colloquially say in the scientific community, be paralyzed through analysis, trying to have perfect science before we actually implement things and do specific actions that we know have worked in the past. There's all sorts of permitting hurdles to get projects in place and implemented. So expediting sort of action is probably what we need to do moving forward. Those investments that I talked about, the $260 million that are on the books, those are all well and good. They're probably going to take 5-10 years to implement. We need to double that amount of action to have an actual measurable water quality benefit that we see in Tampa Bay. So we can't wait around another 5-10 years and study the problem. We need to start implementing actions that have water quality benefits.
This is an interesting one. So how will adapting water consumption from growing populations affect the minimum flow levels of our rivers?
Somebody's done their homework.
Yeah, who wants to take this one?
That sounds like a Sid Flannery question.
You want to take a stab, Warren?
I think they're pointing at me. The local rivers have minimum flows established by the Southwest Florida Water Management District. And those are very rigorous studies that look at the health of the river system downstream to the estuary and into the bay. They look at the historical data to see what's the flow that's needed to make sure that all the pieces of that river system remain healthy. And they set that as a minimum. It's really important for us in water supply. An example is the Alifier River. It has a minimum flow of 120 cubic feet per second at Bell Shoals, in just south of Brandon. We have an intake to take river water for drinking water at that point, but when the flow drops below that point, we take nothing. When it's above, we take a percentage, so the rest goes down to Tampa Bay for the health of the ecosystem downstream of our intake. So the growing population won't really do anything to change the minimum flows that have been set to protect the rivers. It means we have to work harder to find those water supplies projects that are consistent with all the environmental protections and still can leave a neutral footprint on the environment. Environmental stewardship is key to Tampa Bay Water, and we won't promote any project for selection that is not environmentally sustainable.
Okay, this is an interesting one too. Are desalinization plants an option? Did I say that right?
Desalination plants.
Desalination, okay.
Tampa Bay Water has an operating desalination plant on Tampa Bay. It's co-located with the TECO Big Bend Power Plant. It was the perfect location for us to build that plant. Back around 2002, 2004, it became operational. TECO uses water in their cooling water system. We take a piece of that warm water, run it through a plant, take the salt out of that warm water, discharge it back into their cooling canal before it goes out to the bay. Through 20 plus years of monitoring, we've found once that water gets back out to the bay, there's no change in salinity. So we can operate that plant, and it's been rated at 25 million gallons per day with zero environmental impact. By co-locating it with a power plant, we didn't have to build a pipeline out into Tampa Bay to get water or another pipeline out to discharge the brine into the bay. So we avoided digging up part of Tampa Bay for pipelines and damaging the environment in the process. So those partnerships have been very effective, and in the future, further desalination plants are likely up and down the coast of Florida. It's a source that won't go away.
I think this is a great question for everybody, so whoever wants to tackle it first. But if you could magically impose and enforce one, just one policy to improve bay water quality, what would it be? Take a minute and think about it.
Magic?
Mm-hmm. Magic.
Okay. Magic, I would restore all coastal habitat to be natural coastal habitat. So wetlands, mangroves, a really, really solid buffer system between us and the water.
It's hard to beat that one.
It's a good answer.
Yeah, I think living in the reality of 3.5 million people in the watershed, making sure that we're implementing more innovative solutions using gray green infrastructure, which is a buzzword, but thinking beyond the status quo of how we're developing within the region and thinking how we could think 20, 30 years down the road of how these systems are going to operate and improve water quality above and beyond what's needed now because of all the factors we discussed tonight. So not doing the bare minimum just to get things permitted, to get things in the ground, but thinking about intentionally 20 years down the road of what we want water quality to look like in Tampa Bay and building to that standard rather than to a standard that's probably out of date already.
All right, not what I thought you were going to say, but, you know, some nutrients going in the bay, it's very important to have. It helps to provide a food source, start the food chain. But we have so much nutrients coming down in stormwater runoff, it's just overfeeding the bay. So my first thought would be to try to dial back all the material that's coming off our properties, our roadways, our land, our agricultural areas, back to historical levels would make a huge dent. And we know that new development has to treat stormwater runoff on their property, but we have so much old development and so much developmental pressure that a lot of this material is still going out in the bay, and we need to keep up with this huge population growth in the future, too.
I was also going to mention stormwater runoff, and for those older areas, there are projects that we can look at. We got a grant from the Department of Environmental Protection to study the Alafaya River watershed and locate and studied a wetland system on part of the river. And the concept would be to take water that's flowing down the river, divert some of it through this new wetland that would treat out some of the excess nutrients as that water flows back into the river down into the bay. So through those partnerships, we can look at taking those older areas and improving the water that's going to eventually flow into the bay.
Santino?
Yeah, I think it's been touched on, but I think the big thing is, as Ed said, you know, not applying a standard for development that's probably 25 years outdated. I think if we want to continue to have economic development in this region, we're going to have to do it differently. We cannot keep doing the same thing, because I feel like the area has done a pretty good job through these partnerships and kind of holding the line on nutrient loading, but we're not getting the results that we want. So there are other things, other levers that we're going to have to pull, especially in light of some of the other stuff that was talked about. You know, you've got pressure from higher temperatures, and the way water is being delivered to these systems is different. It's coming in big, huge slugs, right, instead of, you know, maybe historically it was more spread out over the year, or at least part of the year during the rainy season. So I would just like to see some changes in terms of new development. And then, as Warren said, going back to some of those older areas where maybe we're still on septic and trying to find ways to make that economical for residents to make a conversion to tie into water treatment. So I really think development is a key thing. And then, as you mentioned, Doctor, we probably can't go back to pre-development conditions, but finding more opportunities to kind of build buffers around developments, you know, preserving some of those areas as we develop. Maybe you don't take all 100 acres of that development. Maybe you set 20% of that aside, you know, for those environmental benefits. So,
okay. Maggie, this is our last question from the audience, and it's for you. How are algae blooms tracked, and how do you know when to test and where to test?
That's a good question. They are tracked very, very heavily here. So there are many agencies that are monitoring water all the monthly, weekly, throughout the entire region. And a lot of those resources are publicly available. So the one that I'm most familiar with is the FWC website. So you can go there and you can see the cell counts for Karenia brevis all along the coast for almost every day. And those measurements are using an instrument called an imaging flow cytobot, which is a very cool, very, very fun instrument where a small stream of water is being imaged, and each cell that goes through the stream triggers a camera where the camera takes a picture of each individual cell, and then there's AI or machine learning that identifies that cell as a Karenia brevis cell or something else cell and automatically counts that and adds it to a map. So that's one way to monitor harmful algal blooms. Some other ways that we do it is just by measuring how much chlorophyll is in the water, and we can do that by taking samples or through satellite measurements. So a lot of like the bloom that I was tracking a couple weeks ago when we were trying to go out on the cruise, that was informed by the satellites. So there's satellites that are looking at the chlorophyll concentration on the surface, and we're like, oh, there is a huge amount of chlorophyll right here, right now. We need to go figure out what exactly that is. So there's all different ways that we're looking at the water, either on the surface or from space, and most of those resources are publicly available.
So I have one last question for all of you as we wrap up this conversation. I'm hoping you can all share what tips you think our audience can take home and use in their daily lives as they're thinking about water quality. What can we all do as stewards, as residents in Tampa Bay, to minimize our impact on our water quality?
I mean, as the fertilizer guy, I mean, that's an obvious one, right? I think if you go back in the industry, it didn't exist 40, 50 years ago. I think most of the large fertilizer companies across the world have that agronomy wing now. So it's really about using the right amount at the right time and not overusing it. I mean, phosphorus in terms of as a mineral resource is a finite resource, right? And until we find other ways, we have 7 billion people plus on the planet now. We cannot support you know, the food needs of the world without chemical fertilizer right now. That's just the reality. So again, using it in a wise way. So at home, you know, obviously a lot of us live in neighborhoods where we've got to maintain the yard looking a certain way. Doing that the right way, doing that the responsible way, as Ed said, there are local ordinances now on when you can use fertilizer. You know, the other piece is water, you know, how you use water. As I mentioned earlier, you know, every person is generating about 100 gallons a day of wastewater, some of us less, some of us more. But, you know, instead of turning on the faucet to brush your teeth, the old example, right? you know, try not to do that, take shorter showers, use appliances and things like that that use less water. So, I mean, it's the little things that add up. It's not just one thing. As we said from the start of this talk today, you know, it's going to take a lot of things because the easy stuff has been done, right? So I would just say, you know, water conservation, you know, make good consumer decisions, use fertilizer wisely would be kind of three of the things that I try to do at home, you know, in my own household.
I'd like to follow while we're talking about water use. I have an attention-grabbing statement. Tampa Bay Water would like to give you money. And we do that through rebates. If you have older fixtures in your home, if you have old toilets that use a lot of water, you can get a rebate from Tampa Bay Water to buy a very highly efficient toilet that uses much less water, or other features in the house. Or if you live in certain areas and you put a smart irrigation controller in so that it tells your yard when, or your yard tells it when to water and when not to water, you'll save a lot of water, you'll save a lot of money, and we'll give you rebates to install those. You can find those on our website, tampabaywater.org. There's the links that will take you so you can find out exactly what rebates you qualify for. Apart from that, look, if you have the opportunity to redo your landscaping, Florida-friendly landscaping is a great way of adding beauty to your yard using less chemicals, pesticides, fertilizers, because those plants in the right place take much less of those resources, and they're sustainable.
I'll give two thoughts. Well, my first thought and wish and tip for everyone in the room is get out on the bay, experience the bay, fall in love with the bay, because if you don't love something, you're not going to protect it. So get out on the bay, experience it, see where it is in its current state, see how it changes through time. If you see things changing in the negative, raise awareness in your community about what the issue is and find solutions. There's grant resources that have been talked about. A more practical thing for particularly those that live in older communities in the region built before 1975. If you've never heard of a private lateral, that's part of our aging infrastructure issues within the region. Private lateral is basically the pipe that comes from your home, collecting all the wastewater from your toilets, flushing your sinks, and it goes into the central sewer line that goes to a wastewater treatment plant. A lot of the problems that we experienced in 2016 and the sanitary sewer overflow events that were experienced during that time from high rainfall conditions were because those pipes were faulty. They were allowing a lot of that rainwater to infiltrate into the pipes, overwhelm our wastewater treatment plants. So there are incentive programs, particularly in Pinellas County right now, and we're hoping other communities will also provide rebates to get that private lateral inspected, and if there are problems, get it repaired or replaced, because that's part of the problems of some of these water quality issues that we're facing within the region now, just from the age of the development that has occurred within our region.
So far, there's been a lot of really, really, really nice suggestions for personal action. I think that we're in a space right now where things are changing really fast and we're losing some really important protections for our environment. I think that we need to do what we can to make sure that the EPA continues to exist and that the Clean Water Act is a thing that we have in this country. So talking to your legislators, making phone calls, telling them that we want to have clean water in Tampa Bay, in Florida, in the United States is really, really important.
That's part of the problem with bringing up the rear. A lot of the great ideas have already been talked about, and I agree and support everything that's been said here. And Ed talked about getting out on the bay. I just wanted to take that one step farther. Get your kids out on the bay. Get your family out on the bay. Tampa Bay Watch, we work with a lot of Title I schools, and they live 15 minutes away. And many of these kids have never been to the beach before. They've never been on a boat before. Many of the things that we take for granted, they haven't even experienced yet. And as the next generation comes to take our place, how do we expect them to protect the things that we've already started if they don't love the Bay. So get your family out, get your kids out, talk to your school teachers, organize programs, come on out and build an oyster bar with Tampa Bay Watch. There's a lot out there that can be done, but it's that basic exposure that's so, so important. And then the other is just to reiterate, you know, if you believe these things we've talked about tonight are important, vote, because our political structure right now really can make a big difference, as we know, one way or the other. So we need to vote for what is important in your heart and what you see each and every day as you drive around Tampa Bay, because it's a place we all love, I know.
Thank you. Please join me in a round of applause for our terrific panelists. Thank you. If you enjoyed tonight's discussion and you registered to be here, you'll get an email with more information about more events like this in our Spotlight series. And we'll also have a video recording of tonight's event that will be emailed to everyone who registered for the event in the coming days. So stay tuned for more from the Tampa Bay Times. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.